Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I welcome you. Today, we're going to begin by another point of view on a New York Times article that suggested or stated that when you're a meat eater and you have carnitine mixing with the gut bacteria, it can cause heart disease. A lot of people construe that to mean that carnitine, L-carnitine, is dangerous. Bill Falloon of Life Extension is following up on a report that we did a week ago showing that there is enormous benefit to L-carnitine. It actually reverses heart disease from the peer-reviewed literature. And they did not take into account what happens if you have a healthy gut bacteria. What if you're a vegetarian? So that will be important to share with you. Also, the latest studies on the Mediterranean diet, especially if you're an older individual, older meaning over than 40. New research on what happens if you consume a lot of salt and you end up with Helicobacter, the bacteria that can cause stomach ulcers. Well, I'll get to that. And community gardens, which are flourishing around the United States, produce more than healthy vegetables, so we have a lot to share. Then I'm going to take a look at a woman who is fighting back against the entire medical establishment of Great Britain, and by extension, the United States and Canada. She is the mother of a child that has autism. The autism developed immediately after the child received the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. I want you to hear, in her words, Isabel Thomas's statement. I think it's extremely insightful. It is the way that more and more Americans and people throughout the world are looking at the medical industrial complex's paradigm for public health and seeing that it is substantially wrong. So Isabel Thomas, her statements. My guest in the second part of our program today is going to talk about something as a continuation of our series on fascism in America. Like it or not, and most people do not like it, we have become a police state. We have an ever-expanding government that is not to our betterment. All reasonable people would support the idea that government is there to defend us, our environment, our water, our food supply, our rights, against those who would in any way assault us. That's why we have civil rights. That's why we have voters' rights, homeowners' rights. That service of government and protecting and expanding the commons, the things that we all use together, that should not be in private hands or privatized. What we have today, if you actually look, if you're not afraid to look, you'll see that we have a giant, deadly metastasis of bureaucracies run by technocrats who have about as much consciousness as a droid. They are reckless in the use of power. We see that almost all the major government programs that are supposed to go to help the people go to private contractors, where the vast majority of the money is absorbed into their operations, overhead, high salaries, teams of lawyers and lobbyists, and very little ever comes to us. We see a government willing to spend over $1 trillion on an airplane. They've already spent $500 billion, and we have nothing to show for it except failure. And yet, they're not willing to rebuild America's infrastructure, our roads, our canals, to protect us from the encroaching sea by building centers in every community, in case there is a disaster, at least people would have a place who would otherwise be homeless to go to. That's reasonable. We don't have any centers for the homeless, and yet we have more than 10 million square feet of unused office space owned by the government that we pay for. We will frequently have 10 different people doing the same identical work. The redundancy is almost incomprehensible, all supported by the corporate Democrats, all supported by the corporate Republicans, those who have betrayed us on both sides. And then we have massive propaganda. The American media, not the least of which is Fox News, is virtually the mouthpiece, the talking heads, the foundations, conservative and liberal, are not true conservative and not true liberal. Instead, they speak for the behind-the-scenes corporate interest. Our state legislators, more often than not, are making their votes on laws that are only and exclusively intended to protect or expand the power of the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council's 300-plus major corporations. Everywhere we look, we see corruption. We see the temptation of those in power to abuse it and use it for themselves and to maintain their power. We're more interested in celebrity news or sports news than we are in critical news. So today I'm going to ask Mark Amdot Bender about the shadow intelligence government created by the growing apparatus of secrecy and surveillance. He was a White House correspondent at the National Journal. He's worked for ABC and CBS News. And we're going to talk about becoming a police state. You'll receive information today that you did not know, and it'll just give you another glimpse at how things have evolved. Unlimited amounts of money for the major corporations, not a penny for the other 99%. Let's begin. This is a rebuttal to the misleading carnitine report from Bill Falloon of Life Extension. It's short, but it says what has to be said. On April 13, 2013, a meta-analysis, that means looking at multiple studies performed by the Mayo Clinic, looked at 3,600 patients and found huge cardiac benefits in those who supplemented with L-carnitine. This study represented the largest, most powerful scientific review of carnitine's cardiovascular benefits to date. The Mayo Clinic study found carnitine supplementation was associated with a 27% reduction in all-cause mortality, a 65% reduction in arrhythmias, and 40% reduction in angina symptoms in patients who had experienced a heart attack. The media simply overlooked this favorable report. Instead, media headlines stories were created based on a report released a week earlier that it asserted that carnitine found in red meat would react with certain gut bacteria in certain individuals to promote a compound called TMAO that would then cause heart disease. These findings were based upon an evaluation of 10 people. You heard me right, 10 people. They were obscure, theoretical, and preliminary. Yet the media ignored hundreds of studies showing significant cardiovascular benefits to L-carnitine, choosing instead to use this study in isolation to bash anything that contained carnitine. The report was thoroughly analyzed, and it was used by the media to attack carnitine, reviewed the published literature on carnitine and heart disease, and conducted a survey of people who use carnitine. It may not surprise you to learn that our findings contradict the mainstream's propagandized carnitine attack. And I think that's very important. So on the one hand, we have 10 people who ate red meat, and what they should have done is what we did over a year ago in a major book that will be coming out in the summer or fall. In that book, I decided to take on meat. I found over 400 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing the damage to our body, to the heart, to the cells, to the gut, to the immune system, when it came to consuming meat, and how it shortens your life, and how it contributes to disease. Instead, we look at an individual nutrient by itself, not from red meat, with 3,600 patients in a cardiac study that had positive benefits and can save lives. Once again, as has happened about every 6 months for the past 20 years, you will see that a nutrient that we take that has overwhelming benefit is attacked. In each and every case, whether it was ginkgo or St. John's wort or vitamin C or vitamin E or beta carotene, we have done a rebuttal. And we will continue to protect the public by showing the truth to the lies. And it's unfortunate. And what bothers me is that the New York Times certainly has some outstanding researchers. They're more than capable of doing the work that we've done with limited resources. And yet, without question, they have never come down on the side of right when it comes to their propagandizing on behalf of industry. Now, following through to show you over 450 studies on the Mediterranean diet, this is just the latest. And mind you, the Mediterranean diet, there are people in the Mediterranean, of course, who eat meat. But the majority of the people use fish, fresh fish from the Mediterranean, as well as an enormous quantity of nuts that we don't eat in the United States. We have this phobia about fat, and as a result, most people who would never think of eating a walnut don't realize that a handful of walnuts thrown into a blender or into a cereal or just eaten helps your heart. They're good fats, not bad fats. But they also eat vegetables. They love their organic fresh vegetables and fruits. In fact, it is the norm to end a meal with a piece of fruit, not simply because they would, let's say, prefer cake or with ice cream. It's because they know from long tradition, and they are correct, that the enzymes in different fruits help facilitate digestion, and they're also very good for you. This is the latest, according to a study published in the Journals of Gerontology, Biological Science. They found that the Mediterranean diet is associated with a lowering of the uric acid levels, especially higher concentrations in men and women. Now, when you have uric acid, you're more susceptible to seeing that manifest in hypertension, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, gout, and cardiovascular death. So the Mediterranean diet, rich in fruits and vegetables and legumes, beans are very common. Almost every meal I ever had in Italy, there were beans. And they have the art of soaking them frequently with salt or vinegar and taking out the gaseousness, and how they combine their foods. First, it's great food to taste, but it's for a purpose. They have lots of wine. Much of it they make themselves, certainly in the country, which is almost no alcohol wine. And they do have poultry, but they have very low meat consumption. And they have low sweet beverages and pastries. It's not big. Well, then you look at the antioxidants and anti-inflammatory properties in the Mediterranean diet, you see then why it's so beneficial. So here you have a group of people, tens of millions, staying healthier longer and living a longer life than the Americans, who are consumed by the idea of rushing out to a fast food restaurant and having as much protein as they could humanly consume. And just to see what the latest is, for the last week I've been monitoring at my desk food shows. I have yet to see a healthy dish prepared on any food channel or any of the popular shows. Every single dish I have seen causes multiple diseases. These are death meals, and yet they're very popular. And the restaurants that serve this food are very, very successful because of the huge portions. And when you realize how full the stomach is, every time someone eats one of those meals, they are speeding up the death process. Something else that can cause a risk to increase with stomach cancer, high salt diet, and ulcers. According to the latest research published in the peer-reviewed journal Infection and Immunity, I'll quote from Science Daily, numerous epidemiological studies have shown that a diet high in salt is associated with an increased risk of gastric cancer. A group of colleagues at Vanderbilt University showed that a high salt and combined with the ulcer-causing bacterium Helicobacter pylori greatly increases the risk of cancer. Well, when you consider how many Americans suffer from H. pylori, you're talking about tens of millions. So these are people all putting themselves at risk. The good news, community gardens, according to Science Daily, quote, people who participate in community gardens have a significantly lower body mass index, as well as lower odds of being overweight or obese, than do their non-gardening neighbors. This was done at the University of Utah, published in the American Journal of Public Health. Quote, it has been shown previously that community gardens can provide a variety of social nutritional benefits to neighborhoods, but until now we did not have the data to show a measurable health benefit for those who use the gardens. Well, now they do. Imagine this. Imagine a city with so much blight. Imagine the ghettoization of almost every city in the United States. You have oases where people are completely immune from the reality of everyone else, and then you have ghettoization. Right now, we are seeing the second of four stages. They'll take about 2 years each for the complete ghettoization of America. Why don't we take some of those ghettos, tear down all the broken down buildings, clear the lots, hire at a living wage local people from the community to work on these, and then put hydroponic and aquaponic gardens that can be used 12 months a year to produce organic fruits and vegetables and tubers to serve the community's needs. Think of how hard it is now for food banks to keep up with the demands. Each year, I try to feed as many people as I can. And on my own farm, whatever food I have stored for my own needs, I give to the local community. It's substantial. It's a whole truckload. Now imagine how many people are underfed in, and this is not in a big city, this is the country. Imagine what would happen if we took a garden the size that I have, which is not large, but we did it efficiently. We could feed in every single community from one garden that's a city block. You could feed about 1,000 people much of what they need, and it would be healthy, microgreens and sprouts, tomatoes. Now imagine if you had 20 or 30 of those gardens in a single community and then start to convert the other empty space into green spaces where people could socialize and have it where the community would have the resources to have a better quality of life. It's easy to do. It's just that the bureaucracies don't think this way. You and I do. Everything we set our minds to do, and we do it well. They just don't count us in because there's always someone more powerful, a real estate developer, saying, just like they did around, for example, when they were building at Lincoln Center, long before Lincoln Center went in, the insiders had already bought up all that property cheaply so they could capitalize on it. That's how they work. But what if they actually had our interests at stake? Then we could start the de-ghettoization of America. Saffron spice is found to reverse macular degeneration and preserve eye health. This is important. This is a good study because a lot of people don't use saffron. First, because they don't know what it is. They don't know how to use it, and it's very expensive. You get just tiny little threads, about the size of a thread out of a garment. That's how thin it is. And it comes from the flower Crocus sativus. And it's a rarity. It's difficult to collect, and it's expensive because of that. But here's what it does. It's been used for the millennia, not only in cooking, but also in healing. It has neuroprotection. It is credited with helping reverse the blinding effects of age-related macular degeneration. Let's remember, macular degeneration is the primary cause of blindness in the United States. And almost everyone over the age of 50 has some form of eye degeneration or cataract formation. And macular degeneration occurs when the most light-sensitive part of the retina is damaged, severely limiting sight of those that would be in their central line of vision. Now, several studies in recent years have indicated that saffron, S-A-F-F-R-O-N, saffron, can hold a natural treatment for this debilitating disorder. One study at the University of Sydney and another in Italy found that those with macular degeneration experienced significant improvement in their symptoms when supplementing with saffron. This was a double-blind controlled trial over 6 months, and half the group got saffron and half got a placebo. Quote, this is from the study, from a professor of neurology at Sydney University. He says, measurements using objective eyesight tests showed patients' vision improved after taking the saffron pill. And these results indicated that early saffron supplementation induces macular and function improvement from baseline that are extended over a long-term follow-up. So my suggestion, when you go to the food store, buy saffron. Put it in your brown rice when your brown rice is finished, when it's you've turned off the flame and properly cooking brown rice, use 2.5 parts water to 1 part brown rice. And the ideal way of making it is you put in to a gallon cooker, you put in 2 tablespoons of organic coconut oil. Then you rinse your brown rice, then you pour your brown rice in slowly, and as you're pouring it in, what happens is that the coconut oil envelops the rice kernel, and therefore you don't overcook it, and it doesn't stick. Then you stir your rice as it's cooking about every 3-4 minutes, just a simple stir, and you don't have to cook it long, and then you turn off the heat, and you put your lid on and let it steep. And then it comes out nice and fluffy, and then you can make a pot of brown rice on a Sunday, and it'll stay fresh for a week, but you can freeze it also and put it in a container, and that way whenever you want some rice and you don't want to cook, it's already made. But then you put your saffron in, like a half a teaspoon, just after the flame is off. And you sprinkle that on top of the rice, and it will absorb right in. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now, before we go to our break, I want to read this letter from Isabel Thomas, because there's a big controversy going on right now in England and Wales, where there's been a big outbreak of measles, and they're blaming Dr. Andrew Wakefield for causing this. Well, this is absolutely absurd, because Dr. Wakefield actually supports the measles vaccine as an individual vaccine. He is against the multiple vaccine, and I will play you a segment. I don't think I'll have time. I know I won't have time today, But on my next program, I will play you his rebuttal, which is about 16 minutes long. I have it, and you'll hear how he virtually destroys the argument that the MMR vaccine is safe or effective. It is neither. And it was when people were taking the single vaccines, you did not have the autism. When they took the MMR vaccine, then you had the autism. And now, instead of being responsible, even the kids, the highest degree, are in the kids that have been vaccinated. Well, hello, if your vaccine is effective, why are they coming down the very diseases that the vaccine was supposed to protect? Statement from parent of two boys in a Lancet study. I, as a parent of two children in the Lancet study, have had to speak out about the vicious attacks on Dr. Andrew Wakefield by his own government, the United States government, the media blaming him for the measles outbreak in Wales. The Lancet study was not paid for by the Legal Services Commission, and our children were referred to the Royal Free Hospital because they were very sick and would still have had investigations done even if they were not a part of the Lancet research, as many more children have done after the Lancet study by other consultants at the Royal Free and other hospitals in London. Dr. Andrew Wakefield listened to the concerns of many parents about their sick children suffering from bowel conditions and a form of autism, a bowel condition and a brain damage that was ignored by other professionals. These parents were demonstrably blacklisted for saying their children became ill after the MMR vaccine. Parents were speaking about this situation years before Dr. Wakefield came on the scene, and our government also knew about these concerns years before the Lancet study, yet they did nothing to investigate, leaving hundreds of other children at risk of side effects. Our government did not listen to parents, but accused them of making the symptoms up and threatening to take their children away if they did not stop making a connection with the MMR vaccine. Yes, they actually threatened, if we condemn the MMR vaccine, to have child services take our children away from us. As a result, these children and young adults live in a great deal of pain to this day. There is much more I could say about the experiences of my family and others, but I want to make it clear that the children's claims in relation to the MMR were supported by many other experts in several disciplines, all of whom provided reports for the court. I'm attaching a list of them. These experts would all have given evidence at the Royal Courts of Justice on behalf of hundreds of children we claim were damaged by the MMR vaccine had the cases been allowed to continue. In addition, the solicitors, those are lawyers, representing the claimants were in touch with and drawing on the expertise of many more of these, but many did not want to be formal experts. I don't know how much the experts listed were paid, but they were all paid fees just as Dr. Wakefield was in the normal way that experts are paid in litigation cases. Now, what's important here is that we've been led to believe, especially by irresponsible reporting by Anderson Cooper and CNN, and I don't know any reporting they do that's not irresponsible and biased, and I just saw the statistics of how many people are watching CNN, and their crucial demographics, 25 to 54, it's like 200,000. Hello? That's all you have? CNN with Time Warner's money? But then again, MSNBC is not far behind, and Fox is also way down. So we're not talking about a lot of people watching these anymore because people have gotten turned off by the lies and the manipulation. But had this gone to court, had the parents who claimed that their children were injured by the MMR vaccine and ended up with bowel disorders and autism, had these experts been allowed to testify, it would have been a game changer all over the world. So they've tried to pin all the blame on Dr. Wakefield. By the way, they took away Dr. Wakefield's license, and they took away the leading gastroenterologist probably in the world. The expert, who's an elderly man, went to court, spent $700,000 in legal defense, and won, completely 100% vindicated, not guilty of anything. Wakefield did not have the money. Otherwise, he would have been vindicated because they were both charged with the same identical misconduct. Here are the experts to give you an idea of just some of the people who would have testified. Professor Dania, Professor of Pharmacology and Cancer Biology and Professor of Neurobiology, Duke University Medical Center. Dr. Kenneth Atkin, Child Clinical Neuropsychologist. Professor William Banks, Professor in the Department of Pharmacology and Physiology, St. Louis University School of Medicine. Dr. Edward Bilski, Associate Professor of Pharmacology, University of New England College of Medicine. Dr. James Bradstreet, International Child Development Center and Professor of Neurosciences, Department of Psychology, Stetson College. A doctor, President Immunologist, MD, PhD, Dr. Vera Byers, Professor Neil Castiglione, Professor of Chemistry, Virginia Tech, Dr. Fletcher, MD, PhD, and Professor Noam Haritz, Mount Sinai Hospital Director in Gastroenterology Pathology, Professor Ronald Kennedy, PhD, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology, Texas Tech University, Marcel Bisbron, Medical Doctor, Research Professor in Cognitive Studies, Tufts University, and Professor of Psychology at New School University, Arthur Krigsman, MD, New York University Hospital, Pediatric Gastroenterology, Dr. Jonathan March, Head of Mycoplasmology at the Morden Research Institute, Edinburgh, Vaccine Development, Molecular Biologist, Professor John Marcellinus, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology, University of Arizona, College of Medicine, Professor John McFadden, Professor of Molecular Genetics at the School of Biomedical and Life Science at the University of Surrey, Professor John Menkes, Professor Emeritus of Neurology and Pediatrics, University of California, and Director of Emeritus of Pediatric Neurology, Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. And there's pages more. So here's what the world and the media did not know. Behind the initial team that found that the MMR vaccine caused a change in the gut ecology, changes that were devastating to the genes and neurological damage, there's a whole legion of scientific medical experts specific to this area that were going to testify on behalf of the parents. And we never heard about them, did we? So this is not the end of the story. This is only the beginning. Quote, the court was not heard and parents did not lose. Ligouet decided to pull their funds for the sick children at the last minute. Ligouet is government run and the government took out an indemnity to protect the drug companies from parents suing, and we are, as parents, had no idea that the litigation case was set up to fail right from the start. The government could not afford for the children to win, and thus they could not afford for the statements from the experts to be read out in court. I have these reports, and I am told they are sealed, and I'm not allowed to produce them. Here below is a summing up, and then they go into the summing up. And here's what the judge at the Royal Courts of Justice said, quote, it is important for the claimant's litigation friends to understand why their children's claims are not being allowed to proceed. It is not because the court thinks the claims have no merit. Listen again what I just said. It is not because the court thinks that the claims have no merit. Although this litigation has been going on for many years, the question whether the claims have merit has never been addressed by the court. The reason why the claims have not been allowed to proceed is because everyone has realistically recognized for some time that it is just not practical for the claims to proceed without public funding. With no realistic prospect of public funding being restored for any of the claims, save for the two which are now to proceed as unitary actions, the dissolution of the litigation became inevitable. In lay language, and that was from Justice Keith, in lay language, what that meant was there was a high probability the parents would win. There is an almost certainty that the experts would have prevailed because they were so diverse from all over the world, the leaders in their field, and would have shown the connection between the MMR vaccine and the problems of the gastrointestinal, mitochondria, and brain abnormalities. And hence, the country could not have afforded to pay the fines, the judgments. This is the first time you've heard this. As I said at the beginning, you will hear things today you did not know existed. So, the association between autism and the MR was never assessed by the UK courts because of the withdrawal of legal aid. But in the United States and Italy, the courts have awarded compensation for the MMR vaccine damage. So that is a continuation. CNN, why don't you actually hire some people who know how to do professional investigative reporting instead of the propagandist hacks that you have on the air? Or at least give the advantage to independent experts coming on to debate the always called upon corporate shills that permeate the airwaves in the United States. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment.
On this heart of mine, I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine. I walk the line.
Normally, we would be taking your Twitter, a new part of our segment, at Dr. Gary. I'm not sure what it is, at Dr. Gary Noll or just Dr. Gary, at Dr. Gary Noll, and you could Twitter us, and I have a whole bunch of Twitters, but if I have a chance at the end of the show, I will get to them, but you can Twitter us, and I'll address it. Let us now go to my guest standing by. Mark, is it I'm not sure how you pronounce your last name.
It's Ambinder.
Ambinder. Okay, thank you.
Yes, it's a complex hybrid European name of origins that I tried to discover and have been unable to.
Well, we appreciate you being with us today, Mark. And I mentioned your background and your credentials earlier on in the program. And the book, The Command, Examining the Secret Joint Special Operations Command, and your recent book, co-authored with D.B. Grady, Deep State, Inside the Government's Secrecy Industry and Unveiling the Scope of the Intelligence Agency's Expanding Climate of Secrecy. Also, you host the blog deepstate.org. Mark, we now have at least 17 independently operating intelligence agencies, very likely more than that, and we have heard critics speak about the waste and redundancy of these entities. How one agency doesn't know what the other is doing, wasted funds, and other criticisms that should raise some alarm about the accuracy and method of intelligence monitoring. And surveillance is everywhere today. And yet, we don't know how many Americans are being spied upon in different methods. If I had to put a top intelligence leader on a psychiatrist's couch, I would expect to find paranoid personalities who feed and support each other's paranoia in order to keep this edifice of secrecy expanding. So begin, please, with summarizing the breadth of the secrecy of this intelligence machine, and then why do you feel the government needs to have such overkill in intelligence gathering?
Well, The breadth is, as you suggested, enormous. And after September 11th, it expanded almost exponentially. And there are several reasons for this. There are functional reasons, and then there are more subtle reasons. The functional reason is simply that the volume of information collected by the existing intelligence agencies and all of the new appendages that they added on afterwards expanded. The type of information, the dimensions of information expanded. the goal after 9/11, as people like General Michael Hayden, who was former director of NSA and then director of CIA, is probably familiar to many of your readers, told me directly, the goal was to build an electronic wall around the United States. That's his phrasing, in his terminology, in order, in his view, in his mind, to keep the bad guys out. But it's impossible, given just the way that we communicate with the outside world and how interconnected we are, to segregate anything Americans do with things that people all over the world do. And fundamentally, when you're trying to build up these intelligence apparatuses and these databases and these data mining operations, even if you're looking for legitimate, you know, pulsing triggers where people are going to do plotting overseas to do things that would cause mass harm in the United States, pulsing up so quickly and without the benefit of oversight and even without the benefit of public input, several things will happen. Number one, you're going to do the wrong things. You're going to over-collect on America. You're going to build the wrong type of equipment and machinery, and you're going to build it, again, very quickly because you're afraid, and when you act out of fear, you often don't act with a sense of proportion. And fundamentally what will happen is these new systems in place will lack legitimacy. And just from the perspective of the government, for one second, if you're going to do something that's big and secret, the chances that it's going to get out in some form, given the ubiquity of information these days, something you were just talking about in your last segment, I mean, it's easy for people who want to share stories and feel they've been aggrieved to do so. You have this entire open source community that is trying to chip away at the secrecy edifice and apparatus. If you're a government, you want what you do to be legitimate. And creating secret policy and hiding secrets from other parts of the government, at the very least, putting aside their intentions, which are certainly subject to valid debate, it makes it illegitimate. And then it takes years and years and years to get it right afterwards, right being a very relative term. One of the big lessons that I took away from the book is that many, if not virtually all, of the major controversial secret policies and some of the horrible things that were done in the name of America could have been avoided had there been mechanisms, informal, mostly informal mechanisms, I mean public debate and public scrutiny, and then formal mechanisms in the sense of oversight and checks on power that the system of government we have is supposed to provide. We could have prevented a lot of that. We really could have. The way that the secrets were kept in many ways perpetuated the abuses that went on in our name that we are still dealing with. You know, if you've read that Constitution Project's report on the torture that was committed by members of the armed forces and the CIA, not just sporadically, but it seems comprehensively. I mean, I hate to use that term in connection with torture in America, but it's the evidence is there. Not all of that can be laid at the feet of the secrecy apparatus and secrecy itself, because there were malevolent actors and people with bad intentions, or people with good intentions who were led astray by the emotions of the moment. But the secrecy apparatus exacerbated unquestionably these abuses.
I appreciate that. Mark,
say one question. Yes, go ahead. I was going to say I didn't answer your question, which is why we need it.
Yeah.
I do think, and you may disagree with me on this, that a functioning government needs to be able to keep secrets to some degree. by the same token, I'm not ignorant of the history of secret keeping and abuses of this government and other governments. And the struggle for me is to figure out where you draw that line, which is why I think more public debate is needed and more information is needed about secrecy and secrets itself.
I certainly agree that there is a need at times, depending upon what you're working on, to keep those that would do us harm from knowing what we're doing to protect us. Some of the geopolitical operations, some of our foreign policy, we have to be careful about that. But I believe everything else should be open. The more transparent a government is, the more transparent the lawmakers are, the more likely we are to believe that our democracy is functioning. But we found out ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, had been operating for 35, 40 years, 300-plus corporations, all multinationals or major corporations, working with state legislators, enacting in 1 year alone over 900 laws, all to their betterment, all to our detriment. There was no transparency. If we knew that our legislators were meeting, we would have had an absolute outcry and say, no, you were elected to represent us. Same way with the lobbyists in Washington. So I believe that there's a lot that we should be transparent about, and we're not, almost on any level. I doubt that many of our listeners would have ever heard of the National Security Agency's surveillance program called Ragtime. Would you please describe what it is and who runs it? What is the primary purpose?
Sure. Ragtime is the formal code name for the series of programs that President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and the National Security Agency put in place after September 11th in order to collect intelligence of all types, emails, telephone calls, real-time credit card transactions, from entities existing outside the United States who are communicating with entities inside the United States. These entities outside the United States, again, according to the strictures of the program, although if this is the way it works in reality, it's hard to say, have to have some connection to a verifiable terrorist counterproliferation, counterespionage threat. Notice I just don't mention terrorism. One of the things I think it's worth mentioning to your listeners is whatever the program, Ragtime, Stellar Wind, which are the same thing. Stellar Wind is an unclassified nickname referring to part of the Ragtime program. Whatever size it existed in whatever form it existed in the few years after September 11th, it is now not only much greater, but it is enshrined into law, and it is allowed to deal with far many more subject matters. Again, counter-proliferation, counter-espionage, malevolent intentions of foreign governments having nothing to do with terrorism. The NSA will say that they were not able to collect on any intelligence streams going into or out of the country so long as one person was communicating them or the communication originated inside the United States without a warrant. And in their minds, an enormous bottleneck was created, and it essentially allowed for, again, I'm going to their justification because something I wanted to understand, terrorism and terrorists to communicate fairly freely and fairly easily, even if there was evidence that the person who was communicating with someone was indeed planning something or was involved in something or had planned something or even had executed something that was nefarious or malevolent. So in a very broad sense, these programs are designed to kind of rectify what the NSA said it could not do because of law, and now can do, which is put an electronic wall around the United States and, based on tips, try and figure out if there are bad people, overseas communicating with bad people inside the United States. The only way to do that, really, is to collect a lot of data and analyze it and look for patterns. That data is going to, by definition, include a significant amount of information, call records, email subject lines, email metadata, that's all the sort of hidden tags that say where an email is going to and from and how it gets there, on American citizens. And it's my understanding that they believe they have the right to keep that information, even if they're not able to use it, for at least 5 years, if not more, if they find that it has some relevant purpose. In very broad sum, and there are more nuances, that's what the ragtime program is.
All right, let's look at it from a little different perspective, Mark. Chris Hedges, Jeremy Scahill, so many individuals who are out there doing outstanding work, Seymour Hersh, there are at least 100 outstanding journalists who are reporting on the illegal activities, unethical activities of our government or its agencies or individuals, and all of them are fully aware that they are being monitored. Now, virtually everything on their computers can be monitored. Any cell phone can be monitored. And now the FBI considers any individual that exposes any harm done to animals that is unethical or illegal, that person becomes a terrorist. They're on a special terrorist list and will be arrested or prosecuted as a terrorist because of a new law that's been passed in different states. I think 27 states now have it. And instead of going after the person that perpetrated a crime against the animals, the abuse of chickens or pigs or cows, whatever it may be, it is the person that reports on it. Also, this president has use the Espionage Act to go after whistleblowers. And if there's one thing that will put a chill on people coming forward, it's looking at what has happened to the other whistleblowers who history showed they were correct. They were not only correct in their assertions, in their allegations, in their evidence, they were morally correct. And yet they are perceived as the enemy. Their reputations are destroyed. They're frequently arrested. What does that say about using the same apparatuses, the same laws to go after any form of dissent, dissent against corporations, dissent against the politicians, or dissent against our governmental agencies, when now you could be put on a terrorist watch list and everything about your life then is reviewed to see where you are vulnerable or culpable?
I think it says a lot, and it's scary in this sense, which is the FBI. Looking at the FBI's history of being used blatantly as a political tool by presidents, particularly when J. Edgar Hoover was director, but even afterwards, there are very, very brief times when the FBI sought to professionalize itself and assert its independence from the president and others in the executive branch. Just imagine, with impunity, the history of the FBI, and I'm sure that you're familiar with it, is just rife with these abuses. Imagine what they can do with all of the information that's now readily available and how easy it is to collect the information.
It's scary.
The prospect for, and I'm personally having, completed the research I did for the book, more worried about the FBI than about the National Security Agency for this reason. The oversight mechanisms that were negotiated between Congress and the executive branch for the National Security Agency came, and these are mechanisms put into place in 2007, came as the result of a corrupt bargain. The bargain essentially being, we'll let the FBI continue to do all that hinky domestic stuff, so long as we, the Intelligence Committee, can scrutinize what the National Security Agency is doing down to the letter to make sure that that program goes okay. I mean, the FBI fabricated pretext for how many national security letters and admitted it several thousand and got a slap on the wrist. Even if you disagree with the notion that the FBI is surveilling journalists, or you disagree with the interpretation of some of what you just said, the public history as admitted by the FBI ought to be enough to make anyone, liberal, conservative, who's concerned about civil liberties, wake up and say, what are we doing? And why aren't we focusing more on pressuring elected officials, people who are running for office? Because I think this is one way that collectively citizens can make a difference. People who are running for office have to answer these questions. We can't just let questions remain the province of activists and radio hosts like yourself. People have to ask elected officials running for office specifically what they would do to rein in the surveillance state, what they would do when it comes to basic questions about targeting American citizens for killing. We don't ask people those questions in our electoral process now. I've covered that process for 11 years on all levels, presidential, senatorial, state politics. We don't ask those questions. We have to start asking those questions. The way we start asking those questions is by, you know, and one of the purposes of the book is to provide information out there so that people can begin to figure out what type of questions to ask. But we have to ask those questions. That's one of the only ways, I think, and it's one of these informal checks I talk about, but it's one of the only ways that we as citizens have to somehow constrain the impulses of people with access to unimaginable power.
Mark,
we hold them accountable at the ballot box. We do our best to do so.
Mark, you've done an exemplary job with Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Agency. The blog is deepstate.org. We appreciate your courage and your scholarship and your commitment to helping Americans hold accountable those who would abuse their powers. Thank you for your good work.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I do appreciate it.
My guest, Mark M. Binder, an American journalist, investigative reporter, and editor-at-large of The Week and a contributing editor to The Atlantic. I'm Gary Knoll. That brings up the end of this program, and I thank you all for listening.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire.